Okay. Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. Happy to have you here tonight. This has been a great season. Tonight is certainly an example of that. And next week we have Koki Tanaka, who is, to my mind, a young Japanese artist who does some really beautiful, innovative, slightly quirky work. If you go to our website, you can read a brief description, and then there's a link to his website, which will give you all kinds of insight into the work, and we'll have you marking your calendar and making sure you're here front and center next Tuesday at 7 o'clock. For anybody who's new, this is an ongoing series. We're running this fall through November 15th. And then we'll start up again in February. There are 10 lectures in the fall and 10 in the spring. It's free and open to the public, something I'm quite proud of for this museum. We just ask that you pick up a ticket at the info desk so we can kind of keep a count of how many we have coming. Tonight, we are quite fortunate to have David Pagel here from L.A., to give us an interesting and likely new perspective on the work of Richard Diebenkorn and some of the artists that worked during his time in California. He's going to do this through the lens of the artist's time and location or place. David has a great deal to offer to this subject as one of the foremost authorities on contemporary art in California and beyond due to his general investment in art and his history and relationship with the West Coast. He is a longtime resident of LA and has been an art critic for the Los Angeles Times for more than 10 years, as well as associate professor of art theory and history at Claremont Graduate University, where he is also the art department chair. David has a BA from Stanford University in Modern Thought and Literature with honors and distinctions in the humanities, and an MA in Art History from Harvard. While having lived in LA for some time, David seems to have covered all possible U.S. art centers, working in various academic and curatorial positions, including visiting critic at the University of Texas, faculty at Otis College of Art and Design, University of Nevada, Santa Monica College, UCLA, the California Institute of the Arts, and he's also been visiting curator at the Blafford Gallery at the University of Houston, adjunct curator at the Institute of Visual Arts at the University of Wisconsin, and currently he's adjunct curator for the Parrish Art Museum in Southampton, New York. In 2002, he was awarded the McGeorge Fellow for the Department of Art at the University of Melbourne, Australia, and he received the Andrew W. Mellon Fellowship in Contemporary Arts Criticism for the California Institute of the Arts from 1990 to 91. David's most recent exhibitions include A Peaceable Kingdom, and that's spelled P-I-E-C-E, Peaceable, Kingdom, Aaron Cosgrove, Assad Falwell, Maxwell Hendler, Laura Krifka, Mimi Lauder, Devin Troy Strother, and Matt Weddle at Beacon Arts in Inglewood, California this year. Also, the critically acclaimed Softcore Hard Edge at Art Gallery of Calgary and Claremont Graduate University in September to December of 2010. Underground Pop, Scott Anderson, Brian Bress, Cole Cass, James Goble, Glenn Goldberg, Leah Jervitz, an artist I'm unfamiliar with, Michael Lazarus, Nathan Mabry, Kristen Morgan, and Jenny Spada at Parrish Art Museum, Southampton, from August to October in 2010, as well as LA Now, another exhibition that received a good deal of press at the Las Vegas Art Museum in 2009, and Damaged Romanticism, A Mirror of Modern Emotion for the Blafford Gallery, which he co-curated with Terry Salton in 2008, Painting Design at Claremont Graduate University in 2010, and Populence at the Blafford Gallery, University of Houston, 2005. In addition to the LA Times, David was has reviewed, was the reviews editor for Arts Issues from 1998 to 2001 and contributing editor for Bomb Magazine 1993 to 2007. Needless to say, David speaks with some authority on art, and we are most fortunate to have him here tonight to present Getting It Wrong in Just the Right Way, Deben Korn's West Coastism. Please join me in welcoming David Plagan.
Thanks, Terry. I'm really happy you invited me, and I'm also really happy that it's a travel day for the World Series, and no one needs to miss the Rangers to come to my talk. I wanted to start off by first fully disclosing that when I was in an undergrad and in grad school, I was exposed to Deben Korn's work and didn't really like it. I thought it was tasteful, mature, and civilized, and that's anything that I wanted to be involved in. You know, that was the opposite of what my interests in the arts were at that time. I thought it was actually art my parents would like, and at that time I wanted to break away from my parents and be something different. Now that I'm probably my parents' age, when I was that age, I find a lot more to like in Deben Korn's work, and I do like that it's mature and composed and resolved and civilized. And that's part has to do with my changing view of things, but also the way art changes over time. And I was looking at thinking about Deben Korn when he started this. This series here, the Ocean Park series in 1967, just after he moved to Los Angeles. And I think that what he did was at that time was just plain wrong. That it wasn't, that if you wanted to be hip and trendy and edgy and avant-garde and contemporary and LA and about the future, you didn't make taut, formalist, modern painting. So I think that when Deben Korn turned away from figuration and turned towards abstraction, what he was doing was getting something just flat out wrong. And I want to link his work to what I think of as a West Coast and a particularly Los Angeles or Southern California way of going about things, where you knowingly don't do what you're supposed to do so you can actually do what you want to do. And to me, it's a way of getting rid of the silliness to get at the seriousness, or kind of it's a way of getting rid of people in it for the foolish reasons to get to it for the real reasons or the important reasons. I think another artist that gets things wrong is John Baldessari. This is one of my very favorite pieces of Baldessari's. It's in the LA County Museum. Every time I see it, I snicker. It's unlike a lot of image and text conceptualism for me, I don't ever feel I get it and I'm done with it. One thing I like about this piece is that it just says so point blank wrong and directly wrong. I think he's actually making fun of image and text conceptualism while he's doing it. So I don't think this piece is like a lot of image and text conceptualism, a critique of general culture, popular culture, consumer culture, middle class culture in the name of high art, meaning, significance, and philosophy, but it's actually a pop critique of all that highbrow stuff in terms of more accessible mixing and matching of kind of a general public, a generic public. What Baldessari did was find how to make good photographs, a little manual or a book that would teach people how to make good photographs. And what he did was take the example is what you're not supposed to do is put the figure in the dead center of the picture and stand there as if the palm tree is growing out of his head. So what he did was in his San Diego suburb was pose in front of the palm tree, had his girlfriend snap the shot, photo silkscreened it to primed canvas, and then it assigned painter right wrong underneath it. So this would have been in the photo manual, the wrong side, and then I imagine the right side would have the composition shifted, the tree nut growing out of the guy's head, and something more tasteful and composed and palatable there. And I think what Baldessari is saying is that as an artist, you don't follow the rules. You don't do what you're supposed to do. You actually have to do things wrong to get at what you want. And I think that what he wants is something quirky, funny, and resonant. So he's like this is the poster child of the wrong world. And if I'm pressing advance... I was pressing it upside down, so it was reverse. The next artist I want to look at is Chris Burden. This is Five Day Locker Piece from April of 1971. It was his graduate show at UC Irvine. And what Burden did was leave the gallery where he was supposed to show his work empty and crawl into one of these lockers and spend the length of the 5 day show in the locker. What he was with the performance pieces he was doing at the time, he would do them and then he would document them with a photograph, a relic, and a short text. That's the photograph. The short text is this: I was locked in locker number 5 for 5 consecutive days and did not leave the locker during this time. The locker measured 2 feet high, 2 feet wide, and 3 feet deep. I stopped eating several days prior to entry. The locker directly above me contained 5 gallons of bottled water. The locker below me contained an empty 5 gallon bottle. And then the relic was the lock, the master lock from the lock. And what I think is just what I love that's so deeply wrong about the piece is that he was really pissing off his professors and not showing his work in the gallery. And he was also, to me, this is the now in an age of celebrity culture, this is the most kind of anti-celebrity gesture you can make, of like crawling into a box and staying there for 5 days. And I think it was also at a time of like great suspicion of subjectivity and artists as mark maker and making gestures and kind of get, it was like a really terrific and concise critique of kind of an expressive model of meaning making and putting something else in place where the artist is there, but the artist is there as kind of going behind the scenes. And even the way he describes it, like he thinks what viewers want to know is, how did I not pee or poop? And it's not, so he's treating his body as this kind of animal organism that has to take in nutrients and expel the waste, and not as something that has feels deep emotions and puts them into the work. Shoot was his next, another piece from 71. And again, there'd be the photograph from the performance, the short text, and a relic. This one, and I'm just going to, it's a pretty brief one. At 7:45 p.m., I was shot in the left arm by a friend. The bullet was a copper jacket 22 long rifle. My friend was standing about 15 feet from me. So again, this is at a time where I think what Burden is doing is looking at art as a research tool where he uses his body as the ground on which the research is done. And I think that he's been, the Vietnam War was raging. There's lots of images of unspeakable violence on the TV and in the magazines and the newspapers. And to me, what Burden is doing, well, I wonder what that feels like. So he just thought, well, there's one way to find out. I'll have someone shoot me in the arm when I can feel it. He did get criticized for being self-aggrandizing and doing anything to shock. But I don't see that as the goal at all. I find that lots of other things much more shocking than this. But I really see it as kind of this earnest inquiry into a person trying to figure out what it's like to experience extreme pain in the world and offer that up as something worth looking into. But that's like the subjectivity of the artist is what he gets deeply, deeply wrong. And he turns it around in a really interesting way. It's the 70s, so there has to be a little bit of nudity. This is called Movie on the Way Down, and it's really getting wrong how Hollywood makes movies. This is not the way to do it. And here's the text for this one. As Burden's performances go on, the texts get a little bit longer. So this one goes like this. Wearing no clothes, I was suspended by my feet with a rope tied to a ceiling crossbeam. I was hanging in the center of a gymnasium above basketball markings, which suggested a target. I held a running movie camera pointed at the floor. In a far corner of the gym, a piano began a light melody, and the audience was permitted to enter. The music lasted for a minute and a half. As soon as the music ended, an assistant in the rafters severed the rope with an axe blow. I crashed to the floor, got up, dressed, and left. What I love about this piece is like if you're in the way you'd make this little short movie in Hollywood is you'd put the camera next to the floor and pull it away. And then to screen it, you'd play it backwards. So you'd create the impression that the viewer is rushing headfirst towards the floor. Chris gets this, as they say, bass ackwards, and he's going to do the real thing and do it. You know, he's going to show you in his little movie what it's like to rush towards the ground. But in rushing there, the evidence of the act gets ruined when the camera shatters and it hits the ground. So what I think he's going for in the piece is like by doing Hollywood special effects wrong, what he's doing then is obliterating the art object and eliminating the distance between the performer and us, the audience, knowing about the piece. So to me, the camera getting smashed, the film being destroyed, the movie never being made is what he has to do. So he has to destroy the art to make the art happen, or he has to destroy the film to make the performance work, which actually really lives in our heads. This one's I Became a Secret Hippie, where he had a star-shaped stud pounded into his sternum by a friend. Then he dressed up in what he calls FBI clothes and had his head shaved. This one, I love the idea that that he's looking at the way we read people, the way we read the look of people and make judgments about them and their politics, and his interest in having the markers of an identity and a position not align with that position. So there's a disengagement between the inside and the outside. To me, it has a lot to do with the five day locker piece. And again, it's not the artist pouring himself into the work to more intimately communicate that to the viewer, but it's the artist making more complex the relationship between his self and the work and the viewer, where you can't read it obviously, but if that's what a secret hippie looks like, well then what do real FBI agents look like? And I think that it's like the work is always embedded in a larger social system where we evaluate and judge and perceive. And my final Burden that I'm going to show you is from 1974. It's called Velvet Water. And to my knowledge, it's the only one that doesn't come with a relic. It's just the image. Here are two images and the text. And it's a little bit long, but it's worth going through because it shows him getting, in a way, much more elaborate than shoot, where it's basically at 7:45 one night I got shot. And it gets much more involved. So pay attention to exactly how Chris talks about this. Separated from the audience by a wall of lockers, I sat next to a small sink filled with water. The audience sat facing a 19-inch monitor framed by 4 9-inch monitors, two on each side. The large monitor showed an extreme close-up of my face and followed the movements of my head during the performance. The small monitor showed a fixed view of my head, shoulders, and the sink. I started the performance by looking directly into the camera and saying, "Today I'm going to breathe water," which is the opposite of drowning, because when you breathe water, you believe water to be a richer, thicker oxygen capable of sustaining life. I repeatedly submerged my face in the sink and attempted to breathe water. After about 5 minutes, I collapsed, choking. The cameras were turned off. I love this piece because to me it gets at the blind craziness and stupidity of being an artist, where you like you know that that's not the way things usually work, but it's just your belief that maybe just this one time you might be able to pull it off. And you know, despite being a rational, science-based, modern human being, you're still going to take a chance on art as this thing that might make something else possible. And I love this one for a burden. It introduces that capacity of like, we don't know what he really believes, but he must believe something else. Because I don't think it's just a stunt or a gag or a kind of a, you know, something on Jackass. It's like a guy really trying to do something with the velvet water. So it's like, again, like he's getting science deeply, deeply wrong to make art possibly be right. This is Scott Greger. He's a artist active in Los Angeles from late 60s through now. He's right now in Los Angeles. There's the Getty-sponsored Pacific Standard Time, which is 170 separate shows at 130 different institutions, looking at art in LA from 1945 to 1980. There's only three artists I know who aren't in the show. Scott's one of them. So he gets a little extra space here. These are his impersonations from 71, just Silver Prince. And it's to me, it's just like, it's so, so wrong at the level of William Wegman dog picture wrong. But like so earnest and heartbroken. And it's like this, you know, such like dopey student, I want to be an artist, so I'll put myself into the work. And it's almost like treating the masterpieces or the canonical works of the 20th century as like tourist sites you visit and do something with. But it's like it's in a way that lets you know that he didn't get what was really going on in the piece. And there's that kind of